Thanks. We good. All right. Well, welcome to the Bitcoin Jam, the March 21st edition. This is no longer the low budget version of SportsCenter, but we do have some new decorative gear hanging up.
We got feedback.
Yeah. So tell me
about
that.
We love audience feedback. And we got feedback from someone in Serbia.
Serbia?
Mm-hmm.
Who we love. Oh. Pavlinex. And hopefully he's in bed watching the show right now live. He wanted some Serbian love on the show.
Okay.
In general, people wanted more flair in our set. It was too bland.
I could agree with that.
Too neutral.
I'm trying to wear my orange Bitcoin shirt here, if you can see.
All right, it's a nice touch.
I got a little pop.
We got lots of flair today.
Yeah. Accoutrement. Your
flair. Let's describe. So some people on the show here aren't basketball fans and might not know what this is. So the request was that we have Nikola Jokic jersey. He is a Serbian NBA player, one of the best NBA players, one of the best basketball players in the world. So I happen to have a Jokic jersey at home.
What? Why do you have a Jokic jersey at home?
I am like closet Serbian. I love Serbia.
Seriously?
I love Serbia because of Rockstar Dev and Pavlinex. Yeah. But no, I went to a Denver Nuggets game to watch Wemby play in his rookie year last year. Him against Jokic, and I went with a couple of mutual friends that David and I have who moved to Colorado. So anyway, I bought a Jokic jersey to fit in with the Denver crowd.
And is he a Bitcoiner or something? Or
probably not.
No connection.
No connection. But he has a connection to our Bitcoiners, Pavlinex and Rockstar Dev.
Okay.
And interestingly, to your point that he's one of the best players, I've seen some pretty interesting, potentially controversial pieces claiming statistically he's the best player of all time.
Well, this year, his stats this year are like otherworldly.
Yeah, in terms of like win shares as well.
And he has at least two MVPs, and he won a championship.
It's impressive.
It's impressive. From a very tiny country, Serbia. Yeah. I'm also wearing flair.
Yep, yeah.
Shout out to my Iowa State Cyclones.
Who won today?
Yeah. I wish we were mutually celebrating, and I really feel sorry for Max.
It's a little tough. As excited as I am to chat here with you guys about Bitcoin, like, I'm not going to lie. I'm pushing for equanimity right now. Right. We're doing this a little bit late today. Normally we stream at noon Pacific time, but both Steve and I had NCAA games. Steve at 10:30. I had my game, Memphis at 11. Iowa State took care of business. Sadly, Memphis did not. And I'm a little bit shell-shocked, thought we had this. I'm reminded constantly that this is like, it's a terrible idea to wrap up your emotions with something you can't control. Sports, if you're not into sports, probably stay away.
I'm with you, man. I feel for you. But at least you'll become an Iowa State fan the rest of the tournament.
Yeah, Iowa State and Gonzaga. I'm going to pull for both of them to do their best. Hopefully, you know, both make the Final Four. So.
Yeah, another colleague of ours, Haley Burko, she is a huge Gonzaga fan. So go Bulldogs.
All right.
One more time. We still do it for them. We'll be back. No Tyrese. We'll be back.
All right. So how about that Bitcoin?
You can tell DK is the biggest basketball fan among us.
Sorry, I don't know. I even went to like a Big Ten state school that's supposed to, you know, Illinois, right? It's supposed to be like a big basketball and sports ball team place. But I studied computer science.
Are they in the tournament this year, David?
I don't know. Sorry, I literally
they
don't
are,
know.
They are.
Okay.
I think they're playing probably.
Big fan.
Awesome. Go Illini. Are they still called that?
Yeah.
Okay. I thought there was some change up from things that had like Native American related personalities or brands. I thought there was
the Redskins. I mean,
whatever they are now. Okay, but Illini is still.
The Cleveland Indians changed their name, but I don't know. Illinois went under
Sticking
the radar.
All right.
Yeah. Old school.
So, so the news that I heard about this Tornado Cash thing you shared this morning, I actually don't know all the background on it, but I did read that. Sounds like Tornado Cash is getting sort of vindicated, or the decisions are sort of reversed from what they were before because of maybe some of the new administration. I think that ties into PayJoin. So I just wanted to tee that up. I know, Steve, you've digested all of this and have a lot to say about it. So educate us. I don't know anything about it.
I have a little bit to say. I mean, I have a lot to say about PayJoin. But starting on Tornado Cash, I think today's news, I believe it's not that different than a few weeks ago. But the bigger story here, Tornado Cash, it was an unprecedented OFAC ruling from two, three years ago, where they sanctioned a smart contract. They sanctioned like cryptocurrency address on Ethereum, or a set of addresses. And
because of a North Korea connection.
Well, Tornado Cash was like something like a quarter of its activity was North Korean money laundering.
Holy shit.
So that's what got the Fed's interest.
Mm-hmm.
But their way of dealing with it was, you know, unconstitutional. And a ruling, I think it was like 3 weeks ago from a judge or court, indeed supported that it wasn't within the law or the regulations to be able to do that. So I think the news today was simply the actual regulatory body lifting those sanctions
and I have,
following the court order. So that's why I don't think it's like new news, meaning there's also open source developers who are facing trial. One in the Netherlands, I think, is in prison or at least was convicted. And then there's a couple in the U.S. that I think are facing trial. So I don't think there's news around that. So they're still facing criminal prosecution, which is of interest to everyone in the space, I think, because if they are found guilty, and in the case of the person in the Netherlands who was found guilty, it's alarming. Or we want to know why would they be found guilty.
Is the claim is it around the open source software development, or is it around the operation of the service that ran the open source software?
Yeah, so the reason why this is a bit of a messy situation, one act is you write software and you open source it, you publish it, and then you don't operate anything and you don't even profit from it. You just publish the software. That's one act. And that would be by far the most alarming
if courts are finding
that to be criminal activity, if others then use that software to do criminal things.
Right.
That would be very bad for society. It would affect cryptocurrency.
That's pure free speech.
But it's unprecedented, or there's no precedent in courts, because it was challenged. Like, it went to appeal to court like 20 or 30 years ago, but then like it's never gone to the Supreme Court in the U.S. And in this case, it was the Netherlands anyway, so it doesn't matter what the U.S. does. It's the Netherlands found them guilty. But one issue is publishing software. Another is, do you actually operate the software and run the software? And I believe in this case, the three developers that are on trial, I think they did operate the software. And then there's another issue. Did they issue a pre-mined token and gave themselves a lot of the money and then profit off of illicit activity, such as North Korean, money laundering?
And those are two issues. If they issue themselves a token, that's one thing. And then if they profit off of that, that's a separate issue, right?
I think so, yes. So okay. All of those are in play, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So what, at least to the Bitcoin community, I think what matters most, or to the broader open source community, by far the most is like people should be able to publish open source software.
For sure.
And then not face criminal prosecution.
Yep.
So that's by far the most important thing. Beyond that, you know, if you are pre-mined, you know, the next thing that Bitcoiners should care about is operating software on a server that's non-custodial. And this definitely starts to get into gray area in the sense that the U.S. absolutely has prosecuted people running mixers before.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the details of every time they've prosecuted that, whether I think maybe sometimes or all the times they've been custodial in nature. And if so, then I don't know if there's legal precedent on non-custodial mixers. I also don't know what the Constitution or the law or the regulations say about that. I think it's gray area. But that's something that Bitcoiners and the Bitcoin community should pay attention to and care about. And then lastly, the pre-mined token stuff, I guess personally I care less about that.
Right.
It's the first two that matter more.
And the second one, do you have a clear picture of the second one? Because I'm a little bit
No, but I was also going to say on that last point, it's not just the token itself, but like if you were profiting, like for example, if you were accepting and taking a cut of payments, is that also an issue? I assume it's the same thing. It's not pre-mined, it's just profiting.
Yep. Which gets into, you know, if then it starts to get into like Silk Road type stuff too, right? What if you don't know? Or like, you know, so what if you're on a marketplace and half the volume is illegal activity? What if 1% is illegal? What if 0.0001% is illegal? Like, is there a threshold? Because it seems crazy. If like a if you run a marketplace that like greatly benefits society and only like one in a billion payments or transactions or whatever are illegal, it seems absurd to like shut that. I mean, that we'd have to shut everything in society down.
Yeah. Right. Starting with all of the banks that have been money laundering for.
So I don't know what the law says there, regulations and like, but I mean, it seemed like pragmatically, I think the U.S. has finite resources, so they don't go after things that are like one in a billion chance. They go after big things. So in this case, something like a quarter of the activity in Tornado Cash was deemed illegal. It was probably like Lazardous Group stealing money and then and laundering it through Tornado Cash. I think we know that as a fact. So they prioritize things like that. So that's so I think today's news, I think, is just an execution of what the court said a few weeks ago. It's definitely a win because it was an abuse of OFAC powers to expand it to smart contracts.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a win, but there's still a lot of other things that are to be determined.
So the second one, I think I get the first one, you should be able to publish open source software. The second one, you should be able to operate non-custodial services. Is that kind of the thing that Bitcoiners should care about?
I think so, because there's another related case, which is Samurai, which I think it's two developers in Samurai are also facing criminal prosecution for a number of charges. And again, looking at each charge matters. I think both charges are conspiracy. So I think one is like conspiracy to launder money, and another is conspiracy around running like a money services business or money transmitter. So that latter one matters a lot to Bitcoin community, because like if you the previous understanding was that if you operate a non-custodial service or server that you don't need to register as an MSB. And in fact, 2019 FinCEN guidance largely said that, or at least that was what normal people and I think lawyers like read on that FinCEN guidance was. So this goes against that guidance. And it could impact a lot of others. In fact, we've seen wallets that have withdrawn from the U.S. out of fear of that.
Is that like what Phoenix did? They withdrew because of fear, even if it's not – it shouldn't be a problem.
And we've seen other startups where like people quit the startup because they were in fear of that risk or whatever. So,
And a lot of startups, I mean, like we talked about this, like Stacker News focused on going non-custodial. Albie focused going on – a ton of startups have done this for this reason. If it all of a sudden becomes illegal to run, you know, whatever, a server where you don't control the keys, you can't see what's going on, that would be a huge waste of effort for all these startups and obviously disappointing for the whole industry. So
I'm wondering, though, like I would guess, I don't know all the details of money services and money transmission, but my guess is there was some legislation that was designed, you know, 40 years ago or something before any of these issues, like made sense or like could be done in this way. And it was just like a very static system in a sense, right? Like it's, you could draw clean boundaries on who takes control of what money and who sends it where. And now that those kind of clean lines are getting diffused, it feels like we need to rethink what they mean and what they are and sort of how regulation should work. So I'm trying to understand what is like, is non-custodial enough? Or like if I non-custodial send something to you through a server that Max runs and we just coordinate it through Max, is that money transmission or money services or neither or both? Like the fact that the money transmitted outside, but maybe the messaging transmitted through Max. Do you know much about the intention of where money services and money transmission came from and what they're trying to prevent? And how does that adapt to the new world?
If you read the BSA law, it's very abstract and wide open to capture almost anything the government wants. So then you have to look at actual regulations, guidance provided by regulatory bodies to get more clarity.
Mm-hmm.
That's why the 2019 FinCEN guidance was viewed as largely positive in the cryptocurrency space, because it was pretty clear on a number of topics. But as we can see, that doesn't stop the DOJ from prosecuting people. But it, yeah, at the end of the day, like almost anything you do is a risk because the BSA is so broad.
And when did BSA come about?
Early 70s.
Okay, so kind of pre-internet.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it seems like probably one of the situations where we need to re-legislate.
Yeah.
Because you know, it is such a radically different world right now. In the same way that I guess we had cryptography fights, maybe that's what the next 10 years are going
to
be about.
I, for a number of years, I have wanted to see someone with like a legal policy background who also, you know, loves Bitcoin and wants to see something like you just said, Max, work on a project where we reimagine the world and imagine a clean slate.
Yeah.
And I don't mean like just total like cypherpunk or like anarchy.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, oh, there is no rules, right. No policy, no law, but just like start from scratch. Imagine eliminating the BSA. Take everything we've learned the past 50 years with the BSA, all the technological developments, including Bitcoin and many other things.
The internet.
The internet, encryption, et cetera, yeah. Like cryptography. Take account. And then also assess where have our regulations actually been effective and where haven't they?
Right.
And also include the costs of regulations that I don't think regulators typically measure. Yeah. And that's the economic friction added with regulations on every company that is regulated. Yep. There's massive costs. Those costs are then borne, you know, are the customers, like normal citizens, bear those costs.
Yep.
Ultimately.
Yep.
And it reduces competition because if once you get big enough, then you actually lobby.
Yeah, you get like regulatory capture.
Yeah, regulatory capture. Yep. You lobby for more regulations because then it's a huge moat because you've already expended lots of money on this huge policy team and legal team and compliance team, and it keeps everyone else out. If you're a little guy, if you're a startup, all you can do is like pray that you stay under the radar, because and operate, you know, in at best gray area, if not illegally, until you get enough growth and success, then you can lawyer up and become one of the big guys.
So, did you have a call to arms? Like, you want to call that if there's somebody who's got policy and legal background and passion about Bitcoin, that they could do that reimagination? What form would that take? Is that like a blog post, or is there somewhere that they could meet or publish around that?
Yeah. I mean, I don't care what format it's in, but some kind of written analysis of that's very comprehensive. And again, it would be written with DC in mind.
Mm-hmm.
Like the audience would be lobbyists, lawmakers, regulatory bodies.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever the right format is for that audience, I don't really care what the format is. It could be a series of blog posts. It could be an academic paper, whatever. But it should be accessible, though. And I guess my hope, I mean, it's still like a bit of a long shot to like literally repeal the BSA. But at the very least, I think it would give the Bitcoin community more credibility.
Yeah.
Because just saying like burn it all down,
right,
is not a super credible solution, because I do believe there's like it's well intentioned what the policies in general are trying to do, like
right.
Protect consumers and like catch the bad guys.
Yeah.
And there really is a lot of criminal activity and there is a lot of fraud. So even though Bitcoiners, including me, love censorship resistant money and people not, the government's not telling us what we can't do, I'm all for that. But there really are
there's bad stuff
in the world, and there do need to be tools to catch the bad guys. I think we would just say it shouldn't operate at the fundamental money layer. It needs to be tools on top of that.
Right.
But I don't think it's credible to just like deny these policy needs for society. So I think a successful project would be like, responsibly take all that in, but also be really, you know, kind of ruthless in the assessment of how effective it's actually been.
One thing I would love to see there, I think it's a great idea, and if someone wants to do this for Bitcoin, amazing. But I would love to see that for like honestly every area of society. Like this is a little bit of a tangent I was telling DK about earlier, but I've been getting re-solar-pilled. Maybe we'll talk a lot more about that on the Earth Day issue. But I think that so many of our laws, like to your point, I wish this was a much more common framework where it's like, okay, if something's been around for 50 years, probably some time to reexamine what was the original intent, what's actually happening, and more importantly, I wish the like common policy perspective was what's the cost of inaction? Because I think almost no one ever says, okay, well, whatever, we stop 1% of these horrible things right. at the expense of 1,000% of innovation or whatever. Similarly, the example I've been thinking about in the case of solar, what's the cost of, we had these environmental protection laws put up, under Nixon or whatever to make it much harder to get more permitting to put solar or transmission lines in the ground. Like, what's the cost of that when you can't build more? Same with housings, all these different things. But that's a bit of a tangent, but I wish we had more of a framework of looking at the cost of an action.
I mean, Doge all the things.
Doge all the things.
So,
but you're not advocating Doge the BSA. You're sort of saying, imagine Greenfield. Maybe the right answer would be that, but imagine Greenfield that you want to accomplish the same goals, but don't actually turn it off right now. You're not an advocate for turning it off, right?
I'm an advocate for being pragmatic, and I don't think the BSA will be repealed without at least a project like this.
Yep.
So the call to action,
like a kickstart the thing.
Yeah, again, I like to convince people to get rid of the BSA. What's the alternative?
Yeah, yeah.
And burning it all down and just like not having, I don't think it's going to succeed.
Right.
So I think at minimum there needs to be this tool
that
shows a vision. Here's how the regulatory the regulations could look like, the policy, public policy could look like with all this new information, the internet, cryptography, Bitcoin, et cetera.
Get the conversation going.
So the call to action here is if anyone listening or anyone wants to do this or knows of someone who might be interested, definitely reach out and contact me. Spiral will be interested in funding such a project.
And they can get you where? Where do they contact you?
Moneyball. On X.
Okay. follow, like, subscribe. But then you were going to talk about how how PayJoin ties into everything we talked about, Tornado Cash, right?
Yeah, well, so PayJoin is a project in the Bitcoin space. It's been a project for – it's been a concept for maybe like 5 or so years, and it's been developed for at least three years. So what is it? It's an open source project, doesn't require any consensus changes to Bitcoin. It can be integrated. It's a protocol that can be integrated into wallets, and it improves efficiency. It makes Bitcoin transactions more efficient, which saves fees, scales Bitcoin better, and it improves privacy as well as sort of like a, You can sell it either way. Like, it improves efficiency, and oh, by the way, it improves privacy, or it improves privacy, and oh, by the way, it improves efficiency. So how does it work? Imagine I'm sending money to Max. I'm sending Bitcoin. Typically, what would happen is be like, if let's say, just to make numbers simple, let's say I'm generous and sending you 3 Bitcoin. So from my wallet, I might have. They're called UTXOs. If you're not familiar with that, it's just imagine if you have like a quarter, 2 dimes, and 3 nickels in your in your pocket, you have to combine them to reach the amount you want to send to Max. So if I need to send Max 3 Bitcoin, I might have a UTXO worth 1 Bitcoin and another worth 2 Bitcoin. So my transaction would include both of those as inputs, and then the output would be 3 Bitcoin to Max. But what's more typical is that like it doesn't perfectly map that way. So there might need to be another output in that transaction, which is changed back to me.
Mm-hmm.
So every input you add, every output you add to the transaction, it requires more bytes,
mm-hmm.
And then it requires more fees. So it costs more money to send that transaction. With PayJoin. Before I talk about PayJoin, what is the problem with what I just said? So it's very common that a sender will include more than one input because they don't have a UTXO that is a sufficient amount to make the payment. So they include 2 or 3 inputs.
Like a lot of people are carrying around pennies in their wallet.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So often there's more than one. There's a heuristic that surveillance companies use called the common input heuristic, which is an assumption that every input and transaction comes from the same wallet, because that's by far the majority of the time today.
Oh, I see.
So in theory, each of those inputs, there's even though those three UTXOs could they're all visible on the blockchain, there's nothing tying them together. So no one knows, and a public observer can't see that they're all the same wallet. But as soon as you spend them together, it's a strong signal. And in fact, the chain analysis companies are used in, first of all, they're used by regulated companies, but they're also used in the criminal justice system to put people in prison. And they have been used to put people in prison. So it is deemed high quality by courts, even though it is probabilistic based and not a certainty, right?
But for it to not be, just to make sure we have the example clear, like if you were paying Max, let's use dollars. If you were paying Max $12 for a haircut, you might have two fives and two ones, and it'd be rare for me to give him one of the fives for your haircut.
Yeah.
So that's...
That's why it's the predominant case that all the inputs to a transaction are from the same person.
Are there examples where it would not be?
Well, certainly coin joins.
Yeah,
like Wasabi,
yeah.
Samurai, Join Market are where people come together to put many inputs in.
But those are all critically centralized, and I'm guessing this is a solution to do that in a decentralized way.
So now, let's introduce PayJoin. So PayJoin... It does what you guys are guessing, right?
Yeah.
Now let's get back to the example. I'm sending Max some Bitcoin. You would also include inputs into that transaction, even though you're the one receiving money.
Okay.
And so let's say this transaction, I'm putting two inputs in, you put one input in, and now but there's still just two outputs, one that goes to you and one goes back to me as change. Or it could actually increase the chances that I don't need change output. It increases the chances that we can sort of get a perfect match.
It'd be like he's paying himself the right amount to make the change not needed.
Yeah,
that's right.
So so I think it increases the probability that there doesn't even need to be a change output, which reduces the size of the transaction, which reduces the fees and improves scaling. It completely breaks the common input heuristic.
Yeah. Right.
Because if this becomes popular enough, and it doesn't have to. Not all users have to do this. Right. Just a threshold. I don't know what the threshold is.
Enough that it's plausible.
Enough that it's plausible.
Any transaction could have been done,
and it won't be using courts anymore. And it really improves. It improves everyone's privacy. So I'm very bullish on PayJoin because it doesn't require consensus change.
Mm-hmm.
It also doesn't have. It doesn't create a footprint on the blockchain like the coin joins do, which taints the coins.
Right.
One risk with using coin joins is now it's obvious to everyone you went through a coin join mixer, and that means services might be like, I don't want to touch them anymore because I don't know, like that's bad stuff happened there, right?
How does this get around that?
Because it's not this like very identifiable pattern of like 100 inputs, all the same amounts.
Got
like
it.
Very identifiable. Here,
because you don't have
here like literally it would be
do you still have to have individuals running coordinators though, or like who's actually coordinating?
So it's unlike this is not a multi-party. It's just the sender,
just the two of us,
just the sender and receiver.
Got it.
So it's very much simpler,
mm-hmm.
and like BTC Pay has supported this for a number of years. So all merchants running BTC Pay can accept PayJoin transactions. So it's the kind of protocol, as a sender, you can sort of be like, hey, like I can send this if you want, or like as a receiver, you can add a flag basically saying,
like, down.
Oh, man down.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. That's the low budget sports center.
Yeah, that was low budget, but hey, it was good. Pavel liked it. Let's see here.
So you're talking about the PayJoin.
Oh, the recipient. Yeah, the recipient can be basically like it's a flag saying like if you talk PayJoin protocol, I receive it, right? And then so for if you're sending me money and you don't talk that protocol, that's fine. Just fall back to the normal. And then if you try to pay me and you do support it, great, we'll use it. So I think it's a credible adoption path.
And I still don't have clear in my mind. Is it like a protocol? and or like an SDK that other wallets would just implement, or how does
just a protocol like in the payment? It's like an addition to the payment protocol. So like when you scan or when you get my QR code, my invoice or whatever, yeah. like my you know like my address that you're paying.
I see.
There's like a little flag there saying like you know
add this.
Hey, do you want to do this?
Join, right, yeah. and then we know, and then if you support it too, we know we can talk that protocol, and we have the software on both sides to speak.
And
that
this
protocol.
Is always through Lightning.
No,
on chain.
It's only on chain.
Only on chain. Okay.
Is there a way to add economic incentives to this as well, so that you can ask, so like I'll pay if someone uses this with me, or is it just two users that want more privacy?
I think it. Yeah, that's a good question. It both. Inherently has economic properties, and you can even negotiate more. Yeah. So, meaning like if you want to incentivize the recipient to use it,
I would pay a little bit more.
You could pay more.
Yeah.
And if the recipient wants to use it, the recipient can give discounts or whatever, right? So that's there's nothing inherent in the protocol to support that, but that yeah. just can naturally be done anyway. Just by changing the amounts, right? But also, even if you don't do that, there. So the I think the my initial take when I learned this protocol is like, oh, but it's going to cost more money, right? Because you're going to have more inputs in the transaction, which costs more money. Like if Max is sending me money, and I add some of my inputs to the transaction, that makes the transaction bigger, costs more money.
However, it
basically gives the recipient the ability to do UTXO consolidation, because yeah. the UTXOs I would choose yep. are, typically would be the smallest ones I have
yep.
that I want to consolidate anyway.
Right.
So also, whether I you know every UTXO you're going to pay fees on it whenever you spend it.
Yeah.
So whether I pay them now or later, I have to. Pay the same fees anyway, given a constant fee rate.
Yeah.
This is another thing too. Like when the fee rates are low, I could be incentivized to do this more.
Yeah.
And when my fee rates are high, I don't.
Right.
Right? Whereas if I delay, then I get to a point where I have to spend these UTXOs and I'm just forced to pay whatever the current fee rates are. So during low fee environments, yeah. it makes sense to basically, this is already anyone who knows anything about UTXO consolidation. That's what you usually get the news from, like Merch. Merch will tweet out saying, like, now's the time to consolidate. Well, that also should be an announcement to anyone who can receive PayJoin, because that's a good time to be more aggressive on PayJoin.
So are PayJoins already available in a wallet or two, or is it kind of just a theoretical idea? Or what's
BTC Pay supports it. Bull Bitcoin, which is a company in Canada, supports mm-hmm. it. And Cake Wallet is I believe in development and close to supporting it. So it's early in the adoption cycle, but it's real. This is not just a concept. The software is real. And it's on the cusp of adoption. But there's more to say here. Because actually on the savings, it's even more than we've been discussing. There's a concept known as transaction batching, which a lot of exchanges have done over the past 7 years. Actually, when I got started in the space, like in 2017, 2018, one of the first things I did as just a volunteer trying to find out how can I help Bitcoin as a volunteer was to join up with a couple other guys to create Bitcoin OpTech. And one mm-hmm. of the things we did, we went around to every company in the space saying, like, how do you, you know, how, you know, because we just got out of the block size wars, and everyone's like, oh, there's to scale, we got to increase the block size. And it's like, well, there's actually a lot of tools that we already have that you don't have to do a consensus change to become more efficient. And at the time, almost no exchange did any of these tools. So we are advocates for like adopting SegWit, native SegWit, and transaction batching. What is transaction batching? Both Coinbase and Cash App are examples where they've adopted transaction batching, and it saves them millions of dollars per year, because what they can do is both of those services, they're doing many withdrawals every 10 minutes, right? So prior to transaction batching, if they had like hundreds or thousands of customers withdrawing in that window of time in a block, they literally created hundreds or thousands of individual transactions that went into the blockchain. Now with transaction batching, they create one Bitcoin transaction, stuff all of their customers, you know, with each, and they only need like one or two inputs from their custodial hot wallet, Mm-hmm. And then they have like, you know, 200 outputs going to every customer. And with and the reason why that saves money is each transaction has overhead beyond inputs and outputs. So if you can eliminate all the overhead from those other hundreds of transactions, right, it's a big win. And it produces huge savings. So this has already been done by most exchanges, but PayJoin takes it up another notch, because also during that window of time, people are depositing into exchanges.
Oh, yeah. So,
so you can do similar types of batching with that
cool.
too.
That's cool.
And there's a and the PayJoin.org website has a great example of these savings. And so and it shows how in the most like basic case, you get 17% more savings. Well, if these big exchanges are spending many millions, if not, I mean, I don't know how much Coinbase spends, but I would guess they spend tens of millions of dollars a year on fees, on on-chain Bitcoin fees. So a 17% savings is millions of dollars.
Right.
Right. So I think there'll be interest purely from a cost savings perspective for exchanges to adopt this.
Mm-hmm.
That would be huge. And then like for individual wallets, certainly any privacy oriented ones where the users care about privacy, they would want to use this as well.
Can you with PayJoin expand it to be more like a CoinJoin as well? So if you wanted to say like a multi, I'll take in.
Great question. Yeah. So I'll explain that. But there's also a really good post that came out this week describing sort of the vision for PayJoin. So I've been describing it as just like one thing, but there's actually a V1, a V2, and a V3 of the protocol. So V1 is what's already integrated into BTC Pay and some other wallets, and it basically works exactly as we've just described. But it's also interactive. So as the sender and receiver, you need to be online connected to the internet the whole time that you're communicating back and forth on adding inputs and adding outputs and then finalizing a transaction.
Yeah,
it's more complicated than a normal Bitcoin transaction. A normal Bitcoin transaction, the receiver doesn't have to be involved at all.
Right.
Like I just, I need to know what your address is or whatever, but you can be on a beach, not on a computer, and I can just create a transaction, sign it, and send you money. You don't have to know anything about that.
Right.
With PayJoin, you need to be online on the internet interacting with me, creating this transaction, right? So for a merchant scenario, that's generally fine because merchants are typically always connected to the internet and available to do that. And if I'm paying the merchant, I'm generally like interacting with my phone or my wallet because I'm in the act of paying for it, right? So V1 works fine in certain scenarios, but in other scenarios, that interactivity is just a showstopper. It breaks the user experience. So V2 of PayJoin actually addresses interactivity so that both the sender and receiver still need to interact, but it doesn't have to be synchronous. It can be asynchronous. So that's what V2 does. And V2 is, I think, sort of like beta ready for testing right now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then V3, to get to answer your question, Max, V3 is multi-party PayJoin. Multi-party meaning more than two, but N parties. It gets a lot more complicated. A developer on the Spiral team has come up with the design for that. He's actually the former architect for Wasabi, so he has a lot of experience with that. But one of his frustrations with Wasabi is the centralized coordinator. So he's been thinking for a number of years how to create it in a decentralized way so there's no choke point. And I'd call it sort of the advanced R&D phase because it's not built yet. So there might still be some wrinkles that we haven't uncovered, that you always discover when writing software. But I think his thinking around it and the design is strong. So that's in this post. It sort of describes that as the future of PayJoin as well. And the nice thing is it can pick any wallet adopting PayJoin today, it should be a relatively easy upgrade to that in the future when it's available.
Is he already thinking, or are you guys already thinking about using Nostr for coordination?
I don't know.
If not, if he's listening,
that would
be a really good use case.
That's a good question. I'd say generally the developers I work with on stuff like that are skeptical just because Nostr is not that well adopted yet. But it's a good question to ask. And anything, you have to compare it to the alternatives.
Yeah.
Like, what would the alternative be? And if there's a strong alternative, then, okay, maybe Nostr is not a priority. But if there's not a strong alternative, well, then maybe that's a reason to support Nostr and help it.
Well, I would also think about the utility of what Nostr can provide. Yes. It's a public messaging service that nobody really controls. And so it doesn't really matter if there's adoption of the social media use case. Like, maybe that's just an extra use case, and the real use case is messaging for payment coordination. Yeah. Like, so effectively, does the tool function for the purpose, not are there a lot of people writing notes?
And I would say if there's – so two thoughts on this. Number one, actually, on the adoption point, I actually think this is very important. I've been pushing for a long time that Nostr – well, actually, this will be a good transition here in a minute. But Nostr should either be pushing for things that can't be done elsewhere, or if you are going to push for more traditional things, start with the Bitcoin community because that's where we do adoption. Yeah. So even if they wanted to say, well, we need users, whatever, it's like the million or so users we have are Bitcoiners. So, like, mm-hmm. it's a starting point.
Push me offline to follow up on that. I totally agree. I don't have a strong answer for, like, why or why not. But let's follow up on that.
But then to your point, DK, I think number two, if I could get one giant message across, especially to the Bitcoin community that is maybe a little skeptical on Nostr, it's like, regardless of social media, like forget social media. I would almost just say
it's almost like it's like a red herring. Yeah,
it is red. It's annoying and obnoxious because people could be like, "Well, the social media, you're never going to be Twitter." It's like, of course you're never going to be Twitter head on. You're going to be
compete against the Swift network or something, right?
Exactly. So I think the best analogy I would say is just like DK said, anything that requires some kind of decentralized either sort of like coordination or lookup. Like I was even telling Carl when he was in here recently talking about VPN stuff. I was like, you know, one great way you could use Nostr is like as a a relay can be kind of, I've got what they call it back in the day, a bulletin board or something where you can like hear our different servers I could potentially click into. I know.
Remember the distance of the mic.
Imagine
it's like a beautiful woman, like your girlfriend.
I don't know about all that. Yeah.
All right.
Don't try and give me in trouble here, Steven. Hold on.
Your girlfriend.
Yeah.
That is your girlfriend. Anyway, last thing I'll say about PageJoin and then let's move on to other stuff. We talked about regulatory stuff earlier. So any regulated company adopting this, they're going to have a compliance team that wants to look at this stuff. That's another potential friction point for adoption. It's interesting, though. All of these companies added transaction batching already, which definitely mixes coins. So it'll be interesting to compare that analysis, why that got a green light, and why this would not get a – why this would not get a green light. And
then it also gets back to transaction batching is feeding, like if Coinbase is feeding that information back into Chainalysis, even if it's not visible on the blockchain, it could be an agreement that they feed it, right?
That could be an agreement, yeah.
Which would make it
It would be a good analysis then from privacy experts and open source developers to know, like, is that a net win or loss?
I'm just observing it could be. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that actually would be...
It's a good point.
That's another, like... follow up I should do to see.
Yeah, we're giving Steve homework.
We're going to check back in next week.
Every
see how far
meeting
we are.
Or podcast I'm on, I have 10 more things to do. But that's a good point. Question. And then also, how does it apply to custodial versus non-custodial? Because you can also imagine a really popular self custody wallet that has like tens or hundreds of thousands or eventually like millions or tens of millions of users, just that wallet could deploy this. Like let's imagine Proton Wallet, which has now launched Proton Mail has launched a Proton Wallet, Bitcoin wallet. They have a huge user base. So let's say that they're really successful in getting a lot of their user base using it. And they have like tens of millions of people sending Bitcoin payments. They could, and they're obviously Proton is like very philosophically aligned with privacy. So you can imagine them deploying PageJoin, and there's enough volume and activity just from their user base to successfully coordinate a lot of multi-party PageJoins.
Yep.
And there's the great thing about it is there's an economic incentive because everyone saves fees. So there's a UX trade-off, though. The longer you have to wait for your transaction to get coordinated with, it might affect you.
Yep.
It just depends on the type of payment you're doing. But it's already an on-chain payment, so you're already accepting. It could take tens of minutes. Well, I was talking about the time. Yeah. I mean, or expensive in time, but like you already know you're gonna have to wait for at least one block confirmation, if not more. So you're already desensitized to this could take an hour.
Right.
So if it takes an hour and 5 minutes, who cares, right?
Right.
It's more like where it hurts the UX more is if you're expecting it to complete in 1 second, like lightning, and then it takes
right.
30 minutes to match someone. That's not a good experience, but that's not what's happening here. And it also can integrate with Lightning.
Yeah.
That's what I was wondering. Yeah. What's the Lightning story here?
A little abstracted from the user, but anytime a wallet does like a splice in or splice out for new channeling capacity, it can be just naturally integrated with PayJoin.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Makes it more efficient, mm-hmm. costs less money, scales Bitcoin, and you gain privacy. So you get all these benefits with this technology. It just needs wallet adoption. So
easy for a wallet to adopt if they want? Like, is it kind of drop some stuff in, or do they often have to retool or rethink how they structured it?
I believe so, especially with PayJoin V2.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the interactivity of V1 is a showstopper for, mobile wallets to receive.
Yeah.
But V2 addresses one of the big drawbacks to integrating it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think it's a matter of championing this, creating awareness, and then time.
Getting early adopters. One quick question on that, because you mentioned Proton Wallet. And I don't know, you may not be able to speak about this. Maybe the guys are listening. Do we have any sense of when they're going to integrate Lightning? Because to me, and from a privacy perspective, you have all those users. Like, I wouldn't use my Proton Wallet until I get Lightning.
Well, that's a great segue into another topic we wanted to talk about.
Yeah.
Can we talk about that now?
Or yeah, let's go.
We can do this first, then Oscar.
Okay. Because it's a big topic. Yeah. So maybe we will touch on this today, and then I will spend hours on this topic. But which is like, how do we scale Bitcoin? Because I just talked about PayJoin scaling Bitcoin, and it has some nice scaling wins, but these are like 20% wins.
Right.
Yeah.
So depending on the context, that's amazing. Like, if it saves your business millions of dollars, awesome.
Yeah.
If it creates an incentive to do more privacy types of behaviors, awesome. But does this scale to millions of payments per second, AI, micropayments, machine to machine? No, 20%, whatever.
Right.
We need many orders of magnitude kind of scale. So, Lightning can give us that. Well, yes and no. Lightning scales amazing in certain ways and not in other ways. The canonical example where it has amazing scaling is like Max and I have a channel between each other. We can make an infinite number of payments between each other that cost nothing, literally cost nothing, and they're all instant. Maybe there's some Lightning variable where we, after like trillions, we have to go back on chain. But I mean, like, effectively, it's infinite scaling. However, when you have a network of these channels and the balances get out of whack, and you need to increase capacity and you have to go on chain, then all of a sudden the scaling breaks down a little bit. Also, the biggest scaling hurdle for Lightning is per user. You can only create so many channels because each channel requires block space, and block space is very scarce, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for people who don't know, just very basic but important background, when you open a Lightning channel, you're writing to the Bitcoin base chain. So however big the block is, like, that's what we got to work with every 10 minutes.
And the ideal scenario, if no one else used Bitcoin for anything other than opening Lightning channels, and we perfectly optimize with batching and every tool we know that theoretically exists, you get something like half a billion per year mm-hmm. of channels.
Which, right? With 8 billion people, it's going to take
multiple
years.
Even if all we did was Lightning channels, it was perfectly optimized, and each person only needed one channel and never had to like create new channels or change the amount in their channel, it's taking like 16 years for humans. And then we have machines and AI and all this other stuff. So it simply doesn't scale to every use case we want. And there's other...
At least today, I know there are some people that are still hopeful in things like channel factories, like potentially working in the future. That has not worked to date, but maybe in the future we will be able to solve it. But
Not really, though. And we'll get into that detail, actually, because let's talk about some of the solutions. So let's start with, what are the problems with Lightning? Yeah. So one is that we already know it does not scale to every use case we can imagine that will come to be. And secondly, it doesn't handle low balances well. And Nostr has highlighted this. So Nostr has highlighted it because you can be a brand new user to Bitcoin by receiving a very small zap. Like, I post something on Nostr, I get 21 sats zapped at me.
Mm-hmm.
And if I want a simple experience with a self-custody Lightning wallet, that would mean a Lightning channel is being opened for me to receive 21 sats. It makes no economic sense because you're having to pay hundreds, if not thousands, of sats to for on-chain fees to open the channel. And then you would want the channel to be of larger capacity than just 21 sats.
Right.
Like, you probably want, like, at least 10,000, if not 100,000 sats, if not more, in that channel to make it useful beyond just receiving a tiny amount of Bitcoin. And for a brand new user to Bitcoin, that particular use case, the likelihood of them sticking around and using Bitcoin is low. They're probably going to churn.
Yeah, yeah.
So any kind of wallet that has a million people sign up that way, and if 950,000 of them churn right away, you have this huge economic cost of opening all these channels that go unused, and like 6 months later, you have to decide, oh, I guess we should close it because they never got used again.
Right.
So it just simply does not handle low balance as well. Most of Lightning's other problems have been fixed or are being fixed for individual self-custody users. But those problems are going to persist. So what do we do? Well, so there are many other projects in the space that have sprouted up to address this and other problems that Lightning has had. We've talked a little bit about Cashew and Fediment.
Mm-hmm.
Those are two eCash projects that we know well, and Spiral Funds both. They address Lightning shortcomings. There's a project called Arc that has come about the past couple of years. It addresses a lot of Lightning's problems. Spark is a new project from LightSpark, which addresses Lightning's shortcomings. Liquid is a longtime product from Blockstream that is now starting to see some adoption to address Lightning's shortcomings. And there's others as well.
And before we jump into all those projects, because there's a ton of pros and cons for all of these, and there's a lot that, like, for example, I'm thinking about from the investing perspective, like, okay, like, where is the actual developer adoption? What's going to win versus, like, what has the regulatory clarity? But I think it's also important to take a step back and say there is another option that's even simpler, right, which is just custodial Lightning, right? And this is what, obviously, you have with things like Cash App. This is what you have with Strike, with Zebedee. And as an aside, I think it's very interesting. This can be its own thread of conversation, but DK has been doing vibe coding. He wanted to integrate mm-hmm. Lightning payments, very simple one line of code. I posted a Twitter thread about it. I think we had like literally half of the Lightning industry jump in.
Yeah, and everybody outpouring of support.
Literally,
yeah.
Like half of the companies that work on this at least were in that thread. And there wasn't a slam dunk answer, which to me is like it's crazy that it's 2025 and that's the state of affairs. Doesn't mean we won't get there, we will. But I do think it's important to recognize even before we solve it in a more non-custodial way, that this was working when things were custodial. Like Albi, you know, quickly blew past 100,000 accounts when they had custodial Lightning. I didn't realize, but it seems like Zebedee has done a pretty good job of getting their sort of regulatory clearance. So one solution, if you can get the regulation that's just easiest, is just do it custodially. That's awesome. That's what Primal does for their wallet. Obviously, that like relies on, you know, the goodwill of the government or whatever laws going your way. So that's why these other solutions are very important. But you know, if you have custodial Lightning, that's not
I mean, it feels like custodial, though, is got to be, I mean, I wish everybody was just cypherpunk and going to go non-custodial, but I feel like it's got to be the first experience that anybody has. I can't imagine how people are having their first experience. They've never heard of Bitcoin or Lightning, and now they get their first payment, and they're already using a non-custodial wallet. Like, I can't see the path where they've figured that out before they even really knew what Bitcoin was.
Well, and I still think there's a huge opportunity, even though I don't love this, but for someone to, like, do the hard work of getting licensing. I guess Strike has done this to a degree, Zebedee to a degree, but it's still, they don't have, I mean, developer mindshare that I know of yet where people are just inserting that line of code like Stripe.
I think we're on the cusp of addressing what you just said, David. And when we talk about each of the technologies, I'll try to highlight that. But yeah, like, I'm definitely not anti-custodial solutions because there are shortcomings to non-custodial. And I'd say the number one problem right now for Bitcoin usage and payments is lack of use cases.
Agreed.
And 100%. Applications.
Yes. Without a doubt.
And actually, I mean, David's a good example. You're trying to vibe code. You're trying to create something. You have the application in mind and you want to add payments. For your project, you aren't hardcore about Bitcoin or anything else, you're not hardcore about custodial or non-custodial. You just simply want to show a proof of concept of your application, right?
Yeah.
And you just want it to work. Like if it's self, you want Stripe for Bitcoin or whatever.
Yeah.
And if it's non-custodial, great. If it's custodial, great. So, and we, like you just said, Max, we no one can deliver the Stripe for Bitcoin yet, custodial or non-custodial. So if initially that's custodial, that's a win for the space. Yeah. Developing use cases and usage, even if it's custodial, is a win for the space. I'm an advocate for the self-custody stuff. First of all, because I think long-term it's essential, and we can get into why I think that. It's also, you know, so that's where Spiral directs its resources is to self-custody, because someone has to do it. If I'm starting a new, if I have a startup and I have a limited window of time to prove product market fit and show growth and pay my employees, like, I don't have the luxury of waiting 10 years for all the self-custody stuff to work out. Yep. So I totally appreciate someone in that boat. Fortunately, Spiral has a luxurious position where we, I mean, we should have a sense of urgency about making progress, but we have time. We don't have to deliver.
You can take longer term.
We can take longer term views. So that's why we do that. But
well, and I would actually add to that. What's been interesting to me is I've actually seen, even though the sort of open source position, it can be more like what's the sort of ideal solution. I, in my own personal experience, at least with the more Lightning sort of SDK type startups, I've seen a lot more people pushing for non-custodial, right? Like, I mean, a bunch of startups that we all know very well, Albi had custodial, now they're all non-custodial. Kian spent a year figuring out how to do a Stacker News non-custodially. Breeze has tried, like, kind of, we'll talk about with the Liquid thing, but like more or less is non-custodial as well. So I think that there is still an opportunity for the Strikes, maybe the Rivers, the Zebedees of the world that want to do one set of like hard work, which is getting the licenses to be able to do Stripe. And that's like very valuable. And, you know, if I were willing to go get those licenses and play that challenge, I think someone can still focus just on the SDK for developers like DKK's there. Amazing. That could be a huge company. But I think what I'm seeing in a lot of startups is they're actually kind of in your camp as well, because that's A, not the game they want to play. These are developers that want to focus on like, how do we actually like, I don't know, enable new kinds of use cases, not solving for the legacy world. And two, it's still like extremely expensive, time consuming. It's like for a lot of these people, that's just not the game they want to play at all. So
totally agree. I mean, as a startup, you don't want to become an MSB and go through all overhead. We already talked about it earlier in a different context, but you don't. So the trend we see right now with mobile wallets is, leaning on, products like Liquid, and there's certainly activity around Fediment and Cashew as well, but the big showstopper with those two is that there aren't reliable mints. So, and then because you don't want to become regulated or take a regulatory risk, you as the wallet developer don't want to be a mint yourself either. Basically, the trend is you want to pass the buck.
Somebody else should be the mint.
So with Liquid, like, you pass the buck, because now like Blockstream and whoever the entities are that are part of Liquid, which is a non-public. It used to be a public list. Now it's not a public list.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Well, it's interesting because they don't want to get in trouble either.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. So, but as a wallet developer, you want to pass the buck, so you pass it to Liquid. That's why there's interest in Spark as well, because you're passing the buck. You don't have to take that regulatory heat. Other people do. So, that explains why there's that trend. But let me explain why I still believe Lightning and things like the LDK project matter, because it's great that we have many other solutions that are gray area, kind of not custodial, but like definitely not self-custody, no matter what the marketing claims are. And I'm happy to go into details as to why. But one day, even if the entities operating the systems don't rug pull and steal the funds, much more likely is that once they grow big enough, the feds will show up one day and knock on the door and be like, hey, we want you to KYC everyone.
Right.
And they can't move their funds until they KYC.
Right.
And anyone who's done KYC on any of these products, it's like a horrible user experience. So totally independent of like the philosophy behind it, and like just from a purely looking at user experience, it's an awful user experience.
Right.
It creates this huge barrier. Like, I've been kicked out of like Coinbase and other stuff, and they want all these documents, even though I've already provided these documents to them in the past. And I just give up. I like don't even use the product. It creates such a barrier that I quit using their product, because I don't want to go through like fumbling around with like, you know, my utility bill and all the stuff I have to prove who I am.
Take a photo.
So it's just like, so for people who are able to KYC and don't care about the privacy aspects, it's a huge burden. Then there's people who care about the privacy aspects. Then there's people who just simply can't get past the hurdle. They don't have the information required. And that describes a lot of people outside of the United States. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be a ton of people on these wallets that one all of a sudden one day they can't access their funds because they need to provide the paperwork and they can't provide the paperwork.
Right.
So it's effectively stealing their money from
them.
Right. That's the end game, sadly, I think, for a lot of these newer systems. So what I'm a proponent of and what Spiral is going to begin working on is what we call a graduated wallet, where it combines LDK with these other solutions. These other solutions do solve the fundamental problems of Lightning. Mm-hmm. So they, we can, you know, by using combining both, we can deliver this great user experience for people. But once the wallet has enough funds to make it economical sense to create a Lightning channel will automatically be created for them. All under the hood, the user just simply sees a balance of Bitcoin. They send and receive Bitcoin. They don't know any other details. They don't have to understand all these technologies. But it could start with Spark. It could start with Liquid. It could start with Cashew. And you plug in any of these and then automatically go to Lightning when it makes economic sense.
So the user experience would be, if I understand, this new kind of graduated wallet would be implemented, say, by like a Nostr client. And if a new user signed up for a new account and posted a note and then I were to zap them, say, 21 sats, they have no channel and let's say they're using a client that's non-custodial, the LDK would sort of figure out if it should be an eCash of 21 cents and it would...
Well, the sort of the thing, I mean, it's LDK wouldn't be involved yet. It would be this, it's a, you know, think of it, it's a higher level wallet SDK, you know, that would have the graduated wallet logic to decide where to go. And then it would have building blocks. It would use BDK and LDK and Spark or Liquid or whatever. Have all these building blocks. But the graduated wallet library would have the logic to figure out, okay, 21 sats, it's a brand new user, brand new wallet, zero balance, and they've received 21 sats, it goes to Spark, or it goes to Liquid.
And is that some sort of an eCash maybe? Like
it
Spark
could go to eCash.
Maybe
so let's say I'm the wallet developer.
Yeah.
I take this wallet SDK, and I decide I want to use, I can choose Liquid or Cashew or
Spark,
but I choose one. It doesn't make sense to have multiple of those. So let's say I choose Spark, for example. Then great. I have my wallet. Like I don't have to do any of the logic of figuring out when to use which. And then then one of my users, like yourself or whatever, receives 21 sats, it goes to Spark.
Yep.
And then you receive, let's say, like $50 worth of Bitcoin. Well, now a Lightning channel is automatically open for you and even automatically done for me as the wallet dev. I don't have to do that work
because
the graduated wallet library is calling into LDK to create the channel, right?
Yeah.
And then automatically shift those funds into the Lightning channel. You as the user just see I have 21 sats, and then later on you have like 240,000 sats or whatever. Or on this show we might call them Bitcoin. So
Presidio.
So as the user, it's all hidden from you, and even as the wallet. Getting back to this, like how do we create a Stripe for Bitcoin Dev UX?
Yeah.
This gets us closer to that North Star of a Stripe for Bitcoin Dev UX. Me as the wallet developer in this example, I also don't have to worry about any of those details.
Yeah. A couple of thoughts will come up to mind immediately. One is we obviously don't know which of these is going to win out yet. Maybe even a solution that hasn't been proposed between Cashew, Spark, Liquid, all this. But maybe it's all of them. And I think one thing just to rehark on is all of them speak Lightning, which is really important. So they're all potentially compatible themselves between the different mints and the Spark operators, or whatever sequencers, whatever they end up being called in the future. So that's really important, number one. Number two, I do think this is awesome in the sense that we can get to that point where any developer can try an app, receive payments. They don't have to like think about any of the hard stuff. That's awesome. Also scales to agents, which is extremely important because you mentioned all the humans that can't provide KYC information. If we want to completely unlock new, you know, potential use cases, we need something like this as well. So I'm all for it. I think it's awesome. I think the thing that I'll be very interested to see is which of these, I know we talked a little bit about this yesterday, but which of these different solutions ends up getting the most sort of adoption. To your point, Liquid obviously has been around a long time. I, to be fair, was very skeptical of Liquid for a long time for many reasons, including I don't know who's operating the Federation. But they have gotten adoption with Breeze. And Breeze, I know I see a lot of companies, they just announced 10 more yesterday that are integrating them. that's very cool. Spark, obviously, I know Lightspark is pushing very hard. I think they're doing great work going out to the crypto communities, doing hackathons, getting people to integrate there. I think there's a very good chance they could kind of bring some of the Solana-type crowd back to something like Spark, which is awesome. I will say just my personal spidey sense from watching, particularly amongst the Nostr devs, but a lot of the cypherpunks, is the eCash, and specifically Cashew. Fedimint has gotten less adoption from what I've seen. I still like the technology, but very little adoption. Cashew, it's crazy. Like in the list that I provided, Cali is sort of the leader of the Cashew project, I would say, the informal leader. He's been like a 100x engineer for a long time, was in Ellen Bits and a couple other things. But I've been super impressed to see, I think they have their JavaScript library integrated in over 100 different projects on there right now. Like it's wild to see. A lot of these are very small experiments. The big problem there, though, is who's going to run the mints? And that's a problem that's completely unanswered. You know, for a long time I heard, well, anyone can just, you know, potentially launch from their Albi or whatever custodial, you'll know they're, you know, running their own Uncle Jim sort of mint model. Very skeptical of that. I think that's cool for like the long tail, but like I don't think Uncle Jim is ever going to scale to a billion users personally. I think, you know, I've heard talk of like, could we have maybe El Salvador or Tether running a mint, or maybe even Cash App one day? Maybe, but that seems like if you can't track a user, like once the money is in, you can't track once they take the token out what they're doing. Currently, that's probably not going to fly with our regulation. Maybe that changes if we get some of the Bank Secrecy Act and other things repealed in the future. Maybe.
How about AI?
Yes. Well, this is where I was going. So when we were having this conversation
yesterday.
That's the long prep. But the big idea that we were talking with Bob and just popped in my head yesterday was, well, what if, okay, so to take a step back, the other big topic we wanted to discuss this week is what can Nostr be useful for? And Jack put on excellent triad of triads. So he had three lists of three things he thought we should be focusing on Nostr. You can go and read that. It's worth reading about that. But the one that was most interesting to me, the one I was most excited to see, the one that I'm personally most bullish on and pushing for, is what can we have agents do on an open data and payment ecosystem in Nostr? Because that's something that can't be done anywhere else on the web. And then when we were talking, Bob yesterday just like went off like a little light bulb. I was like, well, one of the things we could do is we could have these agents run the mints. Like imagine for a minute if you can have an agent that has a Nostr pub key and it has a sub fleet of Cashew or Lightning wallets that it's operating. What if you could literally say, okay, you have one sort of mission in life. Your mission to evolve and reproduce is you need to literally go out there and just make money running this mint. That's it. And you can interoperate with all the other AIs out there. That, to me, is the kind of stuff that, like, if I were a developer starting a company that I would be focused on, because that's something that doesn't exist right now. If you're running a mint, and by the way, you would need features in there like the ability to reproduce yourself and run on multiple servers at once, right? So then you can have plausible deniability of which server is it actually on. Well, it's on 10 servers. Now it's on 20 servers. And I know the AI community, the safety people are going to absolutely hate this. They're going to like completely shit their pants listening to this. But I think that that's like, if you want something like this to scale and you don't want to have to rely on, you know, regulatory uncertainty and 10 years of pushing for legislation, the technological answer, in the same way that Satoshi solved a problem with technology instead of legislation, is figure out a way for the AIs to run the mint.
I think that basically makes sense. But when I try to think about like the path or the steps to get there, I kind of run into these problems. So like if you want to launch an AI that's going to run the mint, like an agent that's going to run the mint, I love that concept. But then how do you get there? I imagine somebody sets up an AWS instance and builds some software and launches it, and then that person is responsible for whatever runs it, right? So is it running in some sort of a virtual machine or addressable, not connected to their account? And does that thing spawn its own virtual machines on new accounts? I just don't understand
how you
decouple from a human ownership.
To be clear, we're still in sci-fi mode here. So yeah. I think there's a lot to figure out. But like, I mean, you could always say for any agent, right? Like, I think this is going to be an interesting philosophical question, legal question for not just our industry, but all industries. If you have a self-replicating agent, right? Is the person that launched the first version of that DNA or whatever you want to call it, are they ultimately responsible?
There's almost maybe some parallels with writing open source software, publishing it, and then others run that service.
Totally.
And for criminal activity.
Exactly.
Who's
in fact,
liable?
There's a guy on Twitter I like a lot called Cocktail Peanut. He has some like crazy out there AI ideas. And he actually, before he got into AI stuff, he did this really nice thing where he was doing inscriptions, but he was using inscriptions to inscribe the open weights for the leaked llama weights for the leaked llama model before Facebook actually published. You remember they were like leaked.
Yeah.
Unclear if that was a real leak or not. But his whole point was like, hey, here's the code to do it. I'm not actually going to run it yourself. Anyone can execute it. And then people started executing it.
Right.
So yes, it does very much get to that. But you could imagine a world where someone writes the code for this first AI agent that self-replicates with the sole goal of running mints and making profit on that, and they just publish the code. And whoever wants to run it, they can run it. Multiple people can run it. I mean, maybe there's still a path of like whoever clicked execute, like who clicked return first, maybe they're the one liable. That's interesting.
But it's almost like you publish the code and then I pick it up and run it. Then I control everything downstream of running it, right?
That's right.
So like the AI, it's sort of the AI doesn't really own the liability. I own the liability.
Well, so I think this is going to get to an important question. Like there's always someone that launches the first piece of code, but like you could imagine it's like the third generation of this. Like the AI agent, you know, perhaps self-replicates.
But does it go to Amazon and sign up for an account so that it's okay, running on, like I assume Amazon is kind of agnostic. There's, it's our hardware. We don't really control it, but they need an account or they're going to be on my account. I'm going to get billed.
So there's
right?
two major breakthroughs that we need here. In fact, on my post on Oster, where I quote tweeted Jack and said, here are some of the things I would like to see AI built on. One of the things I called for is a GPU marketplace, which is similar to what GPUtopia, which is now Open Agents, was building, which is I can list on Oster, using Oster as a shared order book, I can list a GPU and anyone can access that. You know, if you can reach the NPUB endpoint, you can access that and do what you want. So what I imagine happening here is we need an ecosystem, which is going to arise first, but you need an ecosystem all on Oster, which is all open. And that ecosystem allows the agent to access physical resources digitally in a permissionless way. The other key piece of this is what the guys at formerly Mutiny Wallet, now Open Secret, are building, which is absolutely just some of the coolest tech. I didn't get it at first, but as I've started to click on the last couple of months, it's like, wow, this is sick. Which is confidential compute, where you can have some piece of data or whatever code that is running in the cloud, but in a secure enclave. So in their case, they're using AWS and Nitro. I think there's a couple, maybe Microsoft is competing one, I don't know. But what you could start doing is you could literally have, in time, an open marketplaces for GPUs where the code that's executed on that GPU or the key that needs to be accessed is itself, like the person hosting the GPU doesn't know what's happening in there. They can't read it.
Is there any, I assume there must be precedent of like Amazon, Amazon AWS never gets in trouble if you run like North Korea hacker code or something, right? If you just choose to deploy on top of their metal, I assume they're kind of free of liability, but I don't know, is that the case?
I'm not sure on that.
Or has that never been prosecuted?
I'm not aware.
Yeah, okay. If someone's listening to this podcast and they have some,
because that's kind of the analogy, right? And then with the GPU,
but to be clear, it's not the only analogy because there's a couple of new things here. One new thing is with the confidential compute, you could literally say in the past, if I have an account, there's two things. One, if I have an account on AWS, AWS could still see what's running on their server or on their computer. But in this case, you could literally have, you know, some piece of the code or the key necessary to execute the code, or maybe even the code itself, the function. AWS or whoever is hosting,
they don't
it,
know what they're
it's
running.
It's impossible. Like right. they can't see it. The second thing is now for the first time.
Is that something like a virtual machine or no?
I guess you could think of it that way.
Like a virtual machine, confidential compute is like a whole virtual layer that.
I don't know how much you can actually kind of shove in that secure enclave today. I think in the case of OpenSecret, they're mostly thinking about hiding a private key, so like just like one tiny piece of information. But I don't see why, in principle, you know, in time, you couldn't actually have like the whole piece of code in there as well. Perhaps the guys that are working that will be able to chime in. But that's number one. But number two, which is really important, is in the past, if you wanted to run a piece of software in the cloud, you needed to have an account. So I needed to A, be a human, B, have a credit card, C, whatever, have some identification, blah, 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 blah. But like, if we're really thinking towards a world where agents are doing everything and absolutely new things, this is another area where I say, if you're building on Nostra, forget the stupid social media, like go out there, design the marketplace where you're listing the goods so you don't need an account. All you need is to have a private key, which means I can't discriminate against you if you're human, if you're a robot.
And so you access these machines through an NPUB, you said?
That's exactly right.
And there's no IP addresses or anything involved.
So in the platonic ideal of where this goes, yes, there's not even an IP address. It's all listed over NPUB. Maybe the first version you still like just whatever, like like start with IP addresses. But if you kind of start like zooming out and seeing where this could go sci-fi in the future, NPUB is the IP address.
Okay, this answers my questions then, because I could see a path then to get to this future.
So if anyone out there, I'm going to throw this out there, anyone wants to build this future or is thinking about building along these directions, hit me up. This is my number one investment priority. Like all the other stuff is cool. Building Stripe for Bitcoin, like old school payments, awesome. But like if something has a potential to like 10,000x, it's something like this.
Is the Stripe for Bitcoin thing that we're talking about, is that not that would need to exist to be used by this or not?
Well, I'm saying straight
just
for
the
Bitcoin,
simplicity,
that's more
developer
regulatory.
Experience.
Yeah, I mean, ideally you have both, but I'm saying that like, if you had to choose between should I go and get all my licenses so like, you know, X human can use this, or should I just go complete, you know, let it rip in cyberspace? I would choose let it rip.
I have another question about this idea. I mean, it's a great idea to talk about.
It's cool, yeah.
Okay, so some human deploys this, gives it a goal, yeah. Steps back, walks away. But is there literally, like, what's the interface to that AI for giving it commands after that point? Is it really like, I deleted the keys and no one do that again? Or is it still available? Because, you know, if you literally cut off ties, then maybe there's some safety issues there that would need to be discussed more and understood. And if you don't cut ties, then there's rug risk.
Yes.
Because like, it's like, you know, I deploy this and, oh, now I see it's made a lot of money. And like,
right.
Oh, now I'll give it a new command. Send those funds to
me.
So how do you protect? And then even even if it is like, oh, yeah, trust me, bro, I deleted the keys.
Yeah.
Wink, you know, yeah. And I didn't.
There's usually
the
no
keys.
Way to prove that, right?
You can't prove you deleted the keys. So how are you imagining that being addressed?
So these are great questions. Short answer, I don't know. On how you could, there's probably, so the first question I think that's more important is if you wanted to let this thing run on its own, and I agree, there's a lot of safety concerns. Like even though I am generally in favor of let it rip, you know, obviously more responsible is better than not. But even if you wanted to let it rip, I don't know how you could prove that you never had access to the key in the first place. That, I think that should be a solvable problem if you can prove you never knew in the first place. Like one example could be if you like sharded a key. Or something, so you could, I don't know how that would work, but if you could prove like, hey, I only have a third of the key, and like, then you still, I guess, could have the collusion risk, but you could like somehow diversify that, saying, well, we need all these different parties. Or maybe there's even a way that you could say that like, I don't know, like some of the participants in that shard are, I don't know, like random people you don't know or something like
that.
Well,
can you prove that the key the key was generated by the agent?
That would be awesome. But,
like,
but you
it probably
need...
could prove that.
How would that
to
work?
Some level? Well, you have like some server that you access with an NPUB. You take some actions to cause it to start, and then you have open source software that you push with it, and you show the execution of that. That can only be done by your signed key.
Yeah.
And then part of its execution is it generates its
key.
Own key.
Yes.
And you know you can prove with open source software that you don't have access to that key. Presumably, all these layers. I'm just learning about. Confidential compute and stuff. So I don't really have, but it kind of feels like it could make sense.
I agree. So someone who knows more than us should go prove that, but I think that is plausible.
But then it seems like, I mean, I always hesitate to suggest doing a lot of infrastructure before you have apps, but then of course you can't build apps until you have infrastructure. So it's always like a kind of a chicken and egg for both infrastructure and apps. Is like eCash Mint running the very first and most important application for this in your mind? And like, is there a way to sort of say, cause the problem, and then you build this as the solution to the problem you've caused?
So I don't know which is like the best. So I'm quite confident in the future we're going to have agents running around. And I want to come back to your safety point too, because that's important. But agents running around on Noster. What's going to be first to take off? I don't know. I mean, the example that we've seen, the only example in the wild is there's an AI agent that operates a wallet via Noster Wallet Connect. I don't think they figured out how to like run it completely autonomously yet. And it basically learns to beg for sats on Noster. So that's its like economic or like whatever reproduction function is, can I like beg better? I don't think that's obviously like the where I'm interested in. I think
but that's like kind of an important thing to be able to do, because it has to be able to profitably execute its thing so it can keep paying whatever service, you know, there's some infrastructure cost somebody's paying, so it has to be able to pay.
Which is why I think something like, I mean, there's – okay, I'll come up with a couple of
So, like,
ideas.
Tap dancing for SAT seems like an important ability, let's say.
Yeah, I mean –
like, precursor, like, component.
It's certainly one. I mean, personally, I'm much more excited about – running the mints is a good one, I think, because it's, like, solves – like, there's clear – like, it's clear to me that there is demand for developers to build with Cashew. No question on that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a giant unsolved problems, which is no one can run the mints. If you solve that with the AI, there will be demand for it. But I think there's other stuff you could also test with that might also be, like, for example, in the future, Drew from Unchained, you know, he's talked a lot about this sort of evolution of AI. He came up with the idea of just, like, caching. Like, how can you, like, have an agent that all it tries to do is, as an example, there's a Nostr project, I forget the name of, where you can basically take your own ISP or take your internet and you can, like, resell the bandwidth for sats, which I think is super.
Oh, yeah.
It's like Helium without the unnecessary shitcoin.
Right, right.
And you could imagine something like that where, you know, maybe there's an AI agent that specializes in some function around how do I, like, I don't know, like, be really good at caching, or how do I be really good at, like, helping to route, you know, whatever. If I want to access this open network and there's, like, 100 different providers, like, all I do is, like, figure out in real time which one, like, to hook you up with. There's probably, like, a lot of very specific examples, but the Mint one just sounds coolest to me.
We've got to talk about shitcoin tokens, pre-mined tokens. On a future show, we just got to talk about that. That's all.
Can you give us a headline? I mean, I think we all probably have similar instincts, but what's the headline you want to talk about?
Beyond shitcoin's
bad. Sounds like, why mess with it? Like, is there a...
Well, the reason I thought of it is, like, this, you know, Helium without the shitcoin token. Mm. I mean, I think Bitcoiners all along has said, oh, these are, like, interesting projects sprouting up, but you don't need a token. And then people who create the tokens, they come up with all kinds of excuses. But at the end of the day, it's to make a lot of money, even if they don't produce a product that's valuable.
Without a doubt.
That's the conversation. It's been obvious to us for 8 years, many other people in Bitcoin. But people in the crypto community, like, keep making excuses while making bank.
Right.
And it's just all going to go away eventually. Eventually.
Eventually.
If there's actually valuable services to be delivered, they'll be created. They'll use Bitcoin as payments, or maybe stable coins, but not pre-mined tokens.
And this has actually been one of my, like, sort of published theses at HiveMind for a long time, which is, like, hey, crypto community, like, you've got some cool stuff. If you can show me an awesome thing that I would value and I would actually pay real money, i.e. Bitcoin, for it, great. I would invest in that.
Yeah, yeah.
Three ideas I would invest in right now if I could find the right people to do this, which would be the infrastructure needed for a lot of this crazy AI stuff. Most important, someone that does a truly open marketplace for GPUs, just inference. And I know there's different companies and projects invested in some of these.
And, like, GPUtopia was kind of doing that?
Which is why I invested in the first place. I was like, this is genius, because he had actually, like, crazy.
So why are you trying to get him a competitor?
Because he's not focused on that.
Okay.
So he's now focused on something also very cool, open agents.
Why would he give up on that? Was it growth?
Here's the challenge. I think what he saw, and to be clear, this was just one experiment. It was still early. I think if someone was only focused on this obsessively, there's probably ways to hack around that. I think he found other interesting opportunities that were more interesting to him, which is totally fine. But what Christopher found when he was running that project was there was incredible demand on the sell side. So there are a lot of probably ex-Ethereum miners or, like, shitcoin people, whatever, that have these GPUs. And, you know, they're no longer Ethereum, obviously, forked away from proof of work. They can no longer mine with them. Great. So this was an easy way for them just to plug it in and make money and get sats for it. So there was, like, massive demand. Like, I remember I saw in, like, 2 weeks, like, I read the actual numbers, but it was a classic, like, just J curve, just straight up. And I was like, beautiful, let's go. Problem is, there was no demand whatsoever on, like, who wants to use that. Because there's still, but to be fair, there's still a lot of problems to iron out, right? Like, it's like you have a bunch of random people plugging in their, like, GPUs. You still have to come up with, like, you know, good technology and a solution to, like, iron out, make sure it's smooth. If I can plug into using whatever AWS or GCP and it's just, like, it just works and it's simple and this is still kind of janky. Like, there's other cases where maybe you want it because it's censorship resistant. Like, I think there's, if someone were purely focused on just solving, making the user experience smooth and finding those first use cases for people that want a decentralized computer.
Did you suspect it was inference or training focused?
Inference, without a doubt. Definitely inference. I don't think this will work for training yet. People have tried that with training, I think maybe one day, but I think that's way in the future.
Well, why wouldn't it work for training?
Because my understanding is training is much harder to do in, like, a cloud environment. Like, training, you typically, my understanding is you want all of the GPUs, like, strung together. And, like, part of, like, NVIDIA's big winning strategy is, like, making it super easy to have those clusters. I forgot what the networking company they bought was, but, like, super, like, low latency between them. Whereas in this case, in an inference market, it doesn't really matter because I could have, like, some inference in, you know, San Francisco, some other inference in Atlanta, whatever.
Because, like, do you know the company SF Compute?
Yeah, yeah. You told me.
Yeah, because they're sort of solving, I think mostly on the training side of things because.
Oh, really?
Well, because there's a lot of.
But they have a lot of co-located then.
Yeah,
So to be clear, that's very cool. And one way you could, so there's different approaches to this problem, which again, if there's an entrepreneur that really wants to focus on this, hit me up. You know, if you said, okay, well, what we're really going to do is create a cloud, but the clouds have lots of like, kind of like medium-sized providers, like GPU providers that are co-located, then maybe that could, so it's like, okay, none of these guys on their own could take on Amazon, but they're still like industrial scale like businesses.
Right. I think from the demand side, though, they're historically, at least, you know, if you go to a provider, they want to get you for like a year-long contract.
Right.
And if you're like a new startup, you can't commit to that. You don't have the resource. Or if you're like a research lab, like not a research lab company, but like, a, you know, a independent research lab or a small academic lab, you actually want to run like a 2-week run. You don't want like a 1 year worth of training. So it feels like there is a demand side that exists, but I don't know.
So to be clear, and this is actually really worth following up if someone wants to build on this, but when you say training, you don't mean like training the base model. This is more like some kind of like RAG or some kind of like fine tuning.
Yeah.
Okay. I could buy that.
So we have a few minutes left. I think one of the things we teased people, our audience with, was to talk about quantum computing
and the
news around that.
Let's jump in that, but I want to just throw out one last thing, which is the other two marketplaces. So number one, if someone builds on Nostr, open order book for GPUs, I'm extremely interested. The other two are for storage. So Helium without the shitcoin, Filecoin without the shitcoin, and So we did bandwidth, storage, and compute. Oh, yeah. And then, of course, like GPUtopia or whatever. There was Gollum and all this in the last. So storage, bandwidth, compute. If you're building marketplaces for those three things on Nostr, paid, and Zats, I'm very interested.
But not prediction markets.
I'm also interested in prediction markets.
Seems like another good one. Okay.
Awesome. So we want to deliver. There might be an audience waiting this whole time. Hour and a half
through,
to hear about this.
You rug pulled them again.
They're getting rugged. We have Quantum Coin. We'll be launching in.
So we actually talked a lot about quantum computing and potential impacts on Bitcoin.
Yeah, back when the Willow announcement,
a few
right?
months ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, when Google announced Willow. You know, what's new in the past week? I think it was Jameson Lopp posted to the Bitcoin developer mailing list with more of a philosophical question, less about technical, and didn't really get into like his, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, if or when this will ever occur. But the philosophical question is, if we do assume at some point in time there's a quantum computer that is capable of, you know, taking a public key and doing the insane division needed to get the private key and thus being able to steal Bitcoin from people, what do we do about Bitcoin that there isn't a human around anymore either the private keys have been lost or the human's been lost who had the private keys. So even if there is an upgrade path, we're using quantum resistant signatures and cryptography and keys. And everyone who's been paying attention, like, it does upgrade. There's still going to be a lot of Bitcoin that cannot be upgraded.
Like Satoshi's Bitcoin, for
Satoshi
example.
And, no one has the keys. So it'll be unspendable.
Yeah.
Unless you have this powerful quantum computer. So philosophically, what's the best thing to do? Because in general, protocol developers would never want to push an update to software and then suggest to everyone to upgrade to that software, which confiscates coins,
right?
Yeah. That like breaks a fundamental rule.
Yeah.
A fundamental rule is even if it improves the system somehow, improves efficiency or UX or scaling or privacy or whatever, if you're stealing anyone's coins and they can't spend it, that is like you don't go there, right? However, in this case, you're facing an adversary who is going to steal the coins anyway.
Right, yeah.
So is it better? What's the best philosophy? Is it to burn those coins so that no one gets them?
Right.
Or to be like, nope, we don't want to break that principle. Allow the theft. And it could be by a single entity. It could be – think of whoever your biggest nightmare is, nightmare person or entity – whatever you think is the worst is, imagine that entity or person getting all this Bitcoin, which is a better outcome. And, I don't think there's like a definitive – no one can definitively answer that. But it's certainly important to argue the philosophy. There's another layer to this too, though. Even if we did sort of come to consensus on like, okay, yeah, it's best to burn the Bitcoin, let's say. Let's say we actually get sort of consensus on that. People like buy into the argument. Well, when do we do that?
Yeah.
because if we do it prematurely, well, there's still going to be a lot of people saying, like, there ain't a quantum computer who can steal the Bitcoin. Why are we prematurely burning people's Bitcoin, right? And then if you...
You're 1 second too late.
If you wait until there's a quantum computer that steals all the Bitcoin, you're late. So it almost seems intractable to me.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
I feel like even if somehow everyone agrees that's the right philosophy, there'd still be a lot of people disagreeing with forking and a change to Bitcoin, everyone updating to that new fork, which compensates the coins too early, and then you wait, and then it's too late, and then it's over. So that's sort of my summary of the situation.
I think it's a great summary. I think last time we talked about this, originally I was kind of nervous about it, and then went to just like do nothing. I was actually interested in Tareed and Jameson's piece. He was kind of advocating for no, like let's basically burn the coins instead, because you know, it's not fair that like someone else gets to steal the coins without providing value to the network, which is interesting because like he's someone whose opinion I think very highly of. Having said all that, I don't feel super strongly on this. My mind could easily be changed, but I think I'm still in the camp of, to your point, if it seems intractable and you don't want to do it too early, you don't want to do it too late, and there's always going to be like a lot of opposition and it's not really clear, then I think I'm still in the camp of just do nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a developer on my team who has, I think, evolved his own thinking to the camp of like, it's a free for all. And you can argue it's unfair, but it's just kind of like,
this, I think it's fair.
It's kind of Wild West and fair.
That's what Bitcoin is, right? Like,
yeah. Otherwise, you have to have somebody deciding when to do it, and
it just
we want to avoid having that
any
person
decision
deciding.
Becomes way too ethereal.
Yeah.
So I tend to agree with that philosophy. But having said that, this could be something like 6 to 7 million Bitcoin. I mean, imagine if we fast forward 30, 40 years when maybe this is actually
quite a bounty for inventing quantum computing, a real
threat.
I know.
And the world really is, society is highly dependent on Bitcoin. Like, let's say all these dreams we have about AI using Bitcoin, like all that's been realized, and like lots of critical infrastructure and just how people are impacted throughout the world depend on Bitcoin. And then all of a sudden, like, a quarter or a third of all the Bitcoin are controlled by one person.
Well, it's going to be an AI too.
It's going to be
AI. It could be an AI.
It almost certainly will be.
Yeah.
So now you've got an AI.
An AI overlord that has like overlord a quarter that has, of the wealth.
Yeah.
So certainly this is not like a open and shut
case
in terms of discussion. Like, it's very worthwhile of people talking about it.
It does make me wonder. Back to the BCAT project that we've talked about before, what happens when AI is making more consensus decisions?
I've actually been waiting for your PR submission. I think I suggested you open a PR to the BCAT
about
project.
This topic?
Talking about AI as a, like a stakeholder in BCAT.
Okay, maybe we did that before.
We're going extinct. That's the little TLDR. Yeah, I mean, I think I agree that people should be talking a lot more about this. The best sort of example I can come up with, like, okay, 6-7 million coins. I was thinking more along 3 to 4, but even then, that's still a lot.
It's like, big, yeah.
It's a big percentage. But if you think about it in the grand scheme of things, I mean, the closest analogy I guess I would have of this is like, this would be kind of like the shift you get with, you either have like a radical new energy or military technology, right? So there's like a new superpower. And so you basically say, well, you know, once you have the oil and the internal combustion engine and you basically become the new dominant player in the world, or, well, once we got a nuclear bomb, like you become the new dominant player. It's kind of like that. And so the one thing that I maybe wouldn't necessarily disagree with Jameson on, but like would just maybe rephrase a little bit is, I don't think you're not providing any value. Maybe you are not to the Bitcoin network itself, but you are providing, I don't know, like a new fundamental advancement, which is what you said. It's a bounty on a new technology. And like, the reality is there will
kind of
probably,
how history works.
It's just how history works, and there will probably be many examples of this over the next millennia. So.
But it actually is a pretty credible path for how your GPUs in the cloud could get some sort of decisive strategic advantage over humanity. Like, it's kind of credible.
Which the more we talk about this, I should be clear.
Let's end on a dystopian note, shall we?
I'm sure everyone from Anthropic is thrilled to hear all this.
I know we really have to end, but did you guys see the link I sent for Deep Utopia?
No.
Do you know
this is the new Nick Bostrom?
I guess it was published a year ago, like March 2024, I think. If you read Superintelligence, Nick Bostrom.
Yep.
So he has a newish book, I guess it was published a year ago. I just heard about it a few days ago. But it's basically looking at as AI takes off and, you know, kind of is able to do most things, what role do humans play? What should we optimize our energy towards? Like what kinds of activities should we do? And there's kind of three of them. I'm quite
interested. We have a mutual friend working on the same project.
Yes. Yeah. Oh. Actually, we were.
With Nick Bostrom?
Independent study. Is it? Right. He's not. I asked that mutual friend if he had read the book or seen it, and he had seen the same podcast that I saw that put it on my radar.
Okay.
Yeah.
So just quickly on Nick Bostrom, I read Superintelligence some time ago, and this one was in Mexico in 2014 and 2015. And I couldn't sleep. I read like half the book. And I was like, this is fucking terrifying. And I'm glad philosophers like that exist to kind of like get people thinking. I mean, this is a very valid question. But I think one thing I've really changed my view on the last 10 years is like these kind of philosophers with very little like skin in the game in the real world. I take them like much less seriously than I used to. In the sense that, like, that his paperclip thought experiment is like, I think it was he that produced it.
Yeah.
It's certainly an interesting one, but I think it just completely ignores the reality of like having free markets, having competition, how evolution actually works. Some of these questions of like, what are humans gonna do? It's like, I don't know, man. Like, whenever I have free time, like, there's a lot of stuff I like doing. Like, I've been teaching myself the guitar. Like, yeah. You know, I taught myself, you know, like, I think that there's just like, I think it's more a question of how do humans like tap into their own inner voice, what's exciting to them, which is fair, but like, this idea of like, oh, humans are going to be able to do nothing. I think it's silly.
Well, and on the podcast, he makes the point that like, you know, golf is it's just like a made up game, you know, get the ball in the hole and you feel good when it works and you feel frustrated when it doesn't. And there's no point. We all know there's no point and it's still fun. So maybe like the world.
We're all going to play golf.
We're all going to play golf.
I won't be playing.
Make
golf.
Up your own. Maybe and guitar, piano.
March Madness.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay,
yeah, exactly.
March Madness.
Sitting there rooting on a screen. That's what I'll be doing.
So the next edition of SportsCenter is next Friday. We're going to be back to the regular time at noon, right?
It depends on March Madness.
Oh, that's same time?
At least for me. Okay. Sorry, Max is out. So.
I'm out. Okay. So
maybe I lose the vote.
But this happens every Friday at noon. Is that right?
No, it was just unfortunate timing that Memphis and Iowa State happened to overlap with our normal time.
You never know. It all depends.
So we don't know
First
if we're
all,
doing this next
Iowa
Friday
State,
at noon.
We don't know if they're going to win Sunday. Okay. They have to win Sunday. Then they could play on Thursday or Friday. We don't know. And then if they play Friday, we don't know what time. So.
Okay.
The probability.
So
is
we will
good.
Probably
the
be
good.
Noon,
be noon Pacific next
week,
next Friday,
and you have to follow all kinds of brackets if you want to figure out that it's actually at 1:30.
Well, we will notify on X.
Okay,
and so in Noster if we change
about 5 minutes before we start.
About an hour and a half
we'll
after we're supposed
to. We'll do better.
Okay.
<next time.
laughs> All right. I think that's a wrap then.
Until next time.
All right.
See you guys.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.